Chapter 21. A light on the horizon, on the following day, without giving himself any further concern about the Jews' incredulity, the captain gave orders for the Hansa to be shifted round to the harbor of the Shelif. Hakobit raised no objection, not only because he was aware that the move ensured the immediate safety of his tartan, but because he was secretly entertaining the hope that he might entice away two or three of the Dobryna's crew and make his escape to Algiers or some other port. Operations now commenced for preparing proper winter quarters. Spaniards and Russians alike joined heartily in the work. The diminution of atmospheric pressure and of the force of attraction contributing such an increase to their muscular force as materially facilitated all their labors. The first business was to accommodate the building adjacent to the Gorbi to the wants of the little colony. Here for the present the Spaniards were lodged, the Russians retaining their berths upon the yacht, while the Jew was permitted to pass his nights upon the Hansa. This arrangement, however, could be only temporary. The time could not be far distant when ships' sides and ordinary walls would fail to give an adequate protection from the severity of the cold that must be expected. The stock of fuel was too limited to keep up a permanent supply of heat in their present quarters, and consequently they must be driven to seek some other refuge, the internal temperature of which would at least be bearable. The plan that seemed to commend itself most to their consideration was that they should dig out for themselves some subterraneous pits similar to ilos, such as are used as receptacles for grain. They presumed that when the surface of Gallia should be covered by a thick layer of ice, which is a bad conductor of heat, a sufficient amount of warmth for animal vitality might still be retained in excavations of this kind. After a long consultation, they failed to devise any better expedient, and were forced to resign themselves to this species of troglodyte existence. In one respect they congratulated themselves, that they should be better off than many of the whalers, in the polar seas, for as it is impossible to get below the surface of a frozen ocean, these adventurers have to seek refuge in huts of wood and snow erected on their ships, which at best can give but slight protection from extreme cold. But here, with a solid subsoil, the galleons might hope to dig down 100 feet or so, and secure for themselves a shelter that would enable them to brave the hardest severity of climate. The order, then, was at once given. The work was commenced. A stock of shovels, mattocks, and pickaxes was brought from the Gerby, and with Ben Zoof as overseer, both Spanish majos and Russian sailors set to work with a will. It was not long, however, before a discovery, more unexpected than agreeable, suddenly arrested their labors. The spot chosen for the excavation was a little to the right of the Gerby, on a slight elevation of the soil. For the first day everything went on prosperously enough, but at a depth of 8 feet below the surface, the navvies came in contact with a hard surface, upon which all their tools failed to make the slightest impression. Servadac and the Count were at once apprised of the fact, and had little difficulty in recognizing the substance that had revealed itself as the very same which composed the shores as well as the subsoil of the Gallian Sea. It evidently formed the universal substructure of the new asteroid. Means for hollowing it failed them utterly. Harder and more resisting than granite, it could not be blasted by ordinary powder. Dynamite alone could suffice to rend it. The disappointment was very great. Unless some means of protection were speedily devised, death seemed to be staring them in the face. Were the figures in the mysterious documents correct? If so, Gallia must now be 100 millions of leagues from the sun, nearly 3 times the distance of the Earth at the remotest section of her orbit. The intensity of the solar light and heat, too, was very seriously diminishing, although Gorbi Island, being on the equator of an orb which at its axis always perpendicular to the plane in which it revolved, enjoyed a position that gave it a permanent summer. But no advantage of this kind could compensate for the remoteness of the sun. The temperature fell steadily. Already, to the discomfiture of the little Italian girl, nurtured in sunshine, ice was beginning to form in the crevices of the rocks, and manifestly the time was impending when the sea itself would freeze. Some shelter must be found before the temperature should fall to 60 degrees below zero. Otherwise, death was inevitable. Hitherto, for the last few days, the thermometer had been registering an average of about 6 degrees below zero, and it had become matter of experience that the stove, although replenished with all the wood that was available, was altogether inadequate to effect any sensible mitigation of the severity of the cold. Nor could any amount of fuel be enough. It was certain that ere long the very mercury and spirit in the thermometers would be congealed. Some other resort must assuredly be soon found, or they must perish. That was clear. The idea of betaking themselves to the Dobryna and Hansa could not for a moment be seriously entertained. Not only did the structure of the vessels make them utterly insufficient to give substantial shelter, but they were totally unfitted to be trusted as to their stability when exposed to the enormous pressure of the accumulated ice. Neither Servadac, nor the Count, nor Lieutenant Prokop were men to be easily disheartened, but it could not be concealed that they felt themselves in circumstances by which they were equally harassed and perplexed. The sole expedient that their united council could suggest was to obtain a refuge below ground, and that was denied them by the strange and impenetrable substratum of the soil. Yet hour by hour the sun's disk was lessening in its dimensions, and although at midday some faint radiance and glow were to be distinguished, during the night the painfulness of the cold was becoming almost intolerable. Mounted upon Zephyr and Galette, the captain and the count scoured the island in search of some available retreat. Scarcely a yard of ground was left unexplored, the horses clearing every obstacle, as if they were, like Pegasus, furnished with wings. But all in vain. Soundings were made again and again, but invariably with the same result. The rock, hard as adamant, never failed to reveal itself within a few feet of the surface of the ground. The excavation of any silo, being thus manifestly hopeless, there seemed nothing to be done except to try and render the buildings alongside the gorbi impervious to frost. To contribute to the supply of fuel, orders were given to collect every scrap of wood, dry or green, that the island produced, and this involved the necessity of felling the numerous trees that were scattered over the plain. But toil as they might at the accumulation of firewood, Captain Servadac and his companions could not resist the conviction that the consumption of a very short period would exhaust the total stock. And what would happen then? Studious, if possible, to conceal his real misgivings, and anxious that the rest of the party should be affected as little as might be by his own uneasiness, Servadac would wander alone about the island, racking his brain for an idea that would point the way out of the serious difficulty. But still all in vain. One day he suddenly came upon Ben Zoof, and asked him whether he had no plan to propose. The orderly shook his head, but after a few moments pondering, said, "H. Master, if only we were at Montmartre, we would get shelter in the charming stone quarries." "Idiot," replied the captain, angrily, "if we were at Montmartre, you don't suppose that we should need to live in stone quarries?" But the means of preservation which human ingenuity had failed to secure were at hand from the felicitous provision of nature herself. It was on the 10th of March that the captain and Lieutenant Prokop started off once more to investigate the northwest corner of the island. On their way, their conversation naturally was engrossed by the subject of the dire necessities which only too manifestly were awaiting them. A discussion more than usually animated arose between them, for the two men were not altogether of the same mind as to the measures that ought to be adopted in order to open the fairest chance of avoiding a fatal climax to their exposure. The captain persisted that an entirely new abode must be sought, while the lieutenant was equally bent upon devising a method of some sort by which their present quarters might be rendered sufficiently warm. All at once, in the very heat of his argument, Braca paused. He passed his hand across his eyes, as if to dispel a mist, and stood, with a fixed gaze centered on a point towards the south. "What is that?" he said, with a kind of hesitation. "Oh, I am not mistaken," he added. "It is a light on the horizon." "A light?" exclaimed Servadac. "Show me where." "Look there," answered the lieutenant, and he kept pointing steadily in its direction, until Servadac also distinctly saw the bright speck in the distance. It increased in clearness in the gathering shades of evening. "Can it be a ship?" asked the captain. "If so, it must be in flames, otherwise we should not be able to see it so far off," replied Prokop. "It does not move," said Servadac, "and unless I am greatly deceived, I can hear a kind of reverberation in the air." For some seconds the two men stood straining eyes and ears in rapt attention. Suddenly an idea struck Servadac's mind. "The volcano," he cried. "May it not be the volcano that we saw whilst we were on board the Dobryna?" The lieutenant agreed that it was very probable. "Heaven be praised," ejaculated the captain, and he went on in the tones of a keen excitement. "A tour has provided us with our winter quarters. The stream of burning lava that is flowing there is the gift of a bounteous providence. It will provide us all the warmth we need. No time to lose. Tomorrow, my dear Prokop, tomorrow we will explore it all. No doubt the life, the heat we want, is reserved for us in the heart and bowels of our own Gallia." Whilst the captain was indulging in his expressions of enthusiasm, Prokop was endeavoring to collect his thoughts. Distinctly he remembered the long promontory which had barred the Dobryna's progress while coasting the southern confines of the sea, and which had obliged her to ascend northwards as far as the former latitude of Oran. He remembered also that at the extremity of the promontory there was a rocky headland crowned with smoke, and now he was convinced that he was right in identifying the position, and in believing that the smoke had given place to an eruption of flame. When Servadac gave him a chance of speaking, he said, "The more I consider it, Captain, the more I am satisfied that your conjecture is correct. Beyond a doubt, what we see is the volcano, and tomorrow we will not fail to visit it." On returning to the Gerby, they communicated their discovery to Count Timascheff only, deeming any further publication of it to be premature. The Count at once placed his yacht at their disposal, and expressed his intention of accompanying them. "The yacht, I think," said Prokop, "had better remain where she is. The weather is beautifully calm, and the steam launch will answer our purpose better. At any rate, it will convey us much closer to shore than the schooner." The Count replied that the lieutenant was by all means to use his own discretion, and they all retired for the night. Like many other modern pleasure yachts, the Dobryna, in addition to her 4-oar, was fitted with a fast-going little steam launch, its screw being propelled, on the aerial system, by means of a boiler, small but very effective. Early next morning, this handy little craft was sufficiently freighted with coal, of which there was still about 10 tons on board the Dobryna, and manned by nobody except the captain, the count, and the lieutenant, left the harbor of the Shelif, much to the bewilderment of Ben Zoof, who had not yet been admitted into the secret. The orderly, however, consoled himself with the reflection that he had been temporarily invested with the full powers of Governor General, an office of which he was not a little proud. The 18 miles between the island and the headland were made in something less than 3 hours. The volcanic eruption was manifestly very considerable, the entire summit of the promontory being enveloped in flames. To produce so large a combustion, either the oxygen of Gallia's atmosphere had been brought into contact with the explosive gases contained beneath her soil, or perhaps, still more probable, the volcano, like those in the moon, was fed by an internal supply of oxygen of her own. It took more than half an hour to settle on a suitable landing place. At length, a small semicircular creek was discovered among the rocks, which appeared advantageous, Because, if circumstances should so require, it would form a safe anchorage for both the Dobryna and the Hansa. The launch securely moored, the passengers landed on the side of the promontory opposite to that on which a torrent of burning lava was descending to the sea. With much satisfaction they experienced, as they approached the mountain, a sensible difference in the temperature, and their spirits could not do otherwise than rise at the prospect of having their hopes confirmed, that a deliverance from the threatened calamity had so opportunely been found. On they went, up the steep acclivity, scrambling over its rugged projections, scaling the irregularities of its gigantic strata, bounding from point to point with the agility of chamois, but never alighting on anything except on the accumulation of the same hexagonal prisms with which they had now become so familiar. Their exertions were happily rewarded. Behind a huge pyramidal rock they found a hole in the mountainside, like the mouth of a great tunnel. Climbing up to this orifice, which was more than 60 feet above the level of the sea, they ascertained that it opened into a long dark gallery. They entered and groped their way cautiously along the sides. A continuous rumbling, that increased as they advanced, made them aware that they must be approaching the central funnel of the volcano. Their only fear was lest some insuperable wall of rock should suddenly bar their further progress. Servadac was some distance ahead. "Come on," he cried cheerily, his voice ringing through the darkness. "Come on. Our fire is lighted. No stint of fuel. Nature provides that. Let us make haste and warm ourselves." Inspired by his confidence, the Count and the Lieutenant advanced bravely along the unseen and winding path. The temperature was now at least 15 degrees above zero, and the walls of the gallery were beginning to feel quite warm to the touch, an indication, not to be overlooked, that the substance of which the rock was composed was metallic in its nature, and capable of conducting heat. "Follow me," shouted Servadac again. "We shall soon find a regular stove." Onwards they made their way, until at last a sharp turn brought them into a sudden flood of light. The tunnel had opened into a vast cavern, and the gloom was exchanged for an illumination that was perfectly dazzling. Although the temperature was high, it was not in any way intolerable. One glance was sufficient to satisfy the explorers that the grateful light and heat of this huge excavation were to be attributed to a torrent of lava that was rolling downwards to the sea, completely subtending the aperture of the cave. Not inaptly might the scene be compared to the celebrated Grotto of the Winds at the rear of the central fall of Niagara, only with the exception that here, instead of a curtain of rushing water, it was a curtain of roaring flame that hung before the cavern's mouth. "Heaven be praised!" cried Servadac, with glad emotion. "Here is all that we hoped for, and more besides." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.